Vancouver.
Ocean, border, sub, urban, dispersal, determinacy, mulatto, mestizo, Métis, Cabra, Eurasian, Creole, colored, colored, split. Those who have no history are doomed.
An excerpt from The Reinventing Wheel, spoken by author, Vancouver poet, Wade Compton. Celebrate Black History Month with CITR 101.9 FM as we host content exploring Black history in Vancouver and beyond. Tune in this February and check out CITR.ca for regular updates on the scheduling of our Black History Month programming.
The Sustainability Fair is a celebration of student engagement and initiatives in sustainability. We aim to inspire everyone to get involved with sustainability in their own personal way. With activities and displays, participants will explore involvement opportunities and learn how to incorporate sustainability in studies, work, and lifestyle. Visit the fair this February 10th from 10:30 a.m. to 3:30 p.m. in the UBC Student Union Building, Main Concourse.
Something said to me, was there something said to you, said to you? And why the two of us, we found it damn so hard to trust. We've never fit in. Was there something said to us, said to us? Broken hearted lovers, broken hearted, torn apart, broken. Done to us.
This is the sound of compost and recyclables going into the garbage. Garbage that ends up in the landfill creating greenhouse gases. This is the sound of a more sustainable campus. You can make a difference when you sort it out. Learn more at sustain.ubc.ca/sortitout.
Ocean, border, sub, urban. Dispersal, determinacy, mulatto, mestizo, Métis, Cabra, Eurasian, Creole, colored, colored, split. Those who have no history are doomed.
An excerpt from The Reinventing Wheel, spoken by author, Vancouver poet, Wade Compton. Celebrate Black History Month with CITR 101.9 FM as we host content exploring Black history in Vancouver and beyond. Tune in this February and check out CITR.ca for regular updates on the scheduling of our Black History Month programming.
There's a churning around. I can't fall asleep and the drugs won't stay down. There's a burning.
Halifax folkster Ben Kaplan plays at the Fox Cabaret this Thursday, February 12th, with backing band The Casual Smokers and special opening guests. Tickets are $13, available at Zulu, Red Cat, and Northern Tickets, Thursday, February 12th.
But there ain't an option to climb out the luxury.
Canadian music icon Gordon Lightfoot calls Craig Cardiff a songwriter who needs to be heard.
This is the year where we learn to fear. Oh, rent's the cheapest room in the house, dear. Love calls.
Cardiff's innovative and personal live shows are catching on. His acclaimed albums Love is Louder Than All This Noise and Juno-nominated Floods and Fires are available now. To learn more, please visit CraigCardiff.com.
About the earthquake.
Whoever said money can't buy you friends obviously wasn't a member at CITR. When you become a member, you get the Friends of CITR card with incredible discounts on Commercial Drive and other areas at
Bill and Rattle Music Limited, High Life Records, People's Co-op Bookstore, Audio Pile Records, Bad Bird Media, Band Merch Canada, Vancouver Music Gallery, and Pandora's Box Rehearsal Studios.
To find out more, visit us in room 233 of the sub on the UBC campus or go online to citr.ca.
You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded, Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
The CM, the CIR, think I'm clean. Recep Hydra CM Nisiem Nisiaya and the Sakhlia to lead in Homasque Mustail.
I'm a little boy with glasses, the one they call a geek. A little girl who never smiles, 'cause I got braces on my teeth. And I know how it feels to cry myself to sleep. I'm the kid on every playground, the one that's chosen last. I'm a single teenage mother trying to overcome my past. You don't have to be my friend, but is it too much to ask? Don't laugh at me, don't call me names, don't get your pleasure from my pain. In God's eyes, we're all the same. Someday we'll all have perfect wings. Don't laugh at me. I'm a beggar on the corner, you've passed me on the street, and I wouldn't be out here begging if I had enough to. And don't think I don't notice that our eyes never meet. Don't laugh at me, don't call me names, don't get your pleasure from my pain. In God's eyes, we're all the same. Someday we'll all have perfect. Don't laugh at me. I'm fat, I'm thin, I'm short, I'm tall, I'm deaf, I'm blind. Hey, aren't we all? Don't laugh at me, don't call me names, don't get your blame from my pain. In God's eyes, we are all the same. Someday we'll all have perfect wings. Don't laugh at me, don't laugh.
Good morning, good morning. Kaun singa is gan kitu kun is gan kauda hangas hinudi ki ang. Kats akas diu kuala hakun. Tetlanas hat ai udi eating. Good morning, this is Woody. In Haida I have three names. Kaun singa, Kitukun and Kauda Angas. I'm of the two-headed eagle crest. I'm Haida. And today's Family Day. We were just listening to a song by Peter Yarrow. Some of you may remember Peter, Paul, and Mary. I had the opportunity to meet Peter Yarrow last fall and actually to sing for him. He didn't scream and run, so I guess I did a pretty good job. Later, if I can find it, I'd really like to play Puff the Magic Dragon, you know, for a Family Day song. But we'll see where when we get there. I've been looking at some of the stuff in the news, and I see where some people have agreed to sit on a round table dealing with murdered and missing women, Native women, Aboriginal women. And that's... you know, kind of a shame, in a way. Yesterday I was in Safeway, and I was listening to two ladies talking. One was here in Kitsilano, was talking about how the price of everything seems to be going up. And one of them said, you know, in the States you can buy a beautiful home for $100,000 that you couldn't buy for $1 million here in Kitsilano. And the other one said, yeah, but you'd have to live there. So I asked, what's wrong with that? Well, it's a terrible place. You know, people out there. I said, you know, that's quite a shock to me to hear. I was born there. Born in Alaska. Been to all but three states. Went to universities in Alaska, state of Washington, Minnesota, and New Mexico. And do you know anything about Canada's history? Residential school and that sort of thing? Well, that was a long time ago. You know, they're paying them for it. I said, how do you pay off for people where 90,000 kids didn't make it home? Small children. You know, not adults. So how do you do that? And there were a lot of excuses, but they don't know their history. And then you've got Prime Minister Harper, I have trouble with his name. He's been doing all these programs on radio and television about Canada's war record. He's so proud of World War I. He's so proud of World War II. He's so proud of the War of 1812. But he totally ignores the reality of what war does. He thinks it's glorious, and he's screaming because some terrorists are targeting Canada. What do you do when somebody comes and bombs your country? Do you say, oh, gee, thank you for the gift? No, you get angry. But anyway, whether it's right or wrong, he's chosen to portray Canada as a war nation. That's what he wants. But when you look at the War of 1812, I thought it's kind of interesting the way history can get presented by each country. At the end of the American Revolutionary War, there was a treaty in which between the British Crown and the fledgling country of the United States, well, at first it was a confederacy that later became what is now United States. They couldn't make the confederacy work. But anyway, in that treaty, it specifically states that the 49th parallel was not intended to be a line that would forbid Indigenous people from crossing the line. They couldn't do that because militarily they knew if they tried to do something like that, that the tribes were strong enough to wipe out both sides. So instead, it was presented as a buffer zone in which it was not to interfere with the free trade and intercourse of the Indigenous peoples of that region. So they had free access going back and forth across this demarcation zone. It was simply to set a boundary between the British Empire lands of Canada and this new nation. In War of 1812, at the end of it, a treaty was signed, which is a peace treaty, which means it was an agreement about ceasing hostilities. And one feature of that treaty was that the language that was in that treaty, that Jay Treaty, I guess it was, or Treaty of Ghent, I forget which one is which, that the language in it that said that it didn't interfere with the free access of the native peoples on both sides was included into the Jay Treaty, or included as part of this peace treaty at the end of the War of 1812. And so the United States honors it. Any Native person, Native American person, or person of Native American ancestry who chooses to go and live in the United States simply presents himself at the border crossing with a long form of their birth certificate, two affidavits from elders saying that this person is at least 50% by blood quantum of Native American ancestry, and two ID photos. The paperwork is done there. The person is issued a Social Security number and permanent residence. They can live in the United States, work, whatever, for all the rest of their lives. But that doesn't work coming to Canada, because Canada's policy is that this was not an international document. This was left to the domestic laws of Canada. So I, Ida, born across the north side of Dixon Entrance from Haida Gwaii, am Ida. When I came to Canada, I had to come as an immigrant. Canada does not recognize that those provisions of the Jay Treaty. So you talk about an egalitarian society, and yet it's a very closed nation. You take a look at what's going on with CSIS, there is absolutely no oversight. There's simply nobody to say no, but to accept an apology after something happens. And so when we take a look at these things, all the exclusion laws, everything, the residential schools of thousands of First Nations people, not only murdered, tortured, sexually abused, and now we have, it continues with communities that don't have medical facilities, they don't have clean water, houses are falling down. All these things were promised in those treaties that this would not happen. And so the attitude is just brush them aside. They're only impeding progress. They get in the way of making money. So if this was truly an egalitarian nation, people look at their history and say, instead of saying we're not as bad as the Americans, we're not as bad as somebody else, you can't fix a problem until you admit you have it. I had a problem with rage, anger, and I didn't even know I had a problem until I was in my 40s. And then once I discovered I had a problem, I had to figure out what to do about it. How do I deal with it? It's the same with drugs and alcohol. You can send somebody away for detox 50, 60 times, but nothing's going to happen toward that person's healing until that person says, I've got a problem. I've got to deal with it. And so here in Canada, we don't recognize we have any problems. All we say is we're not as bad as somebody else. And I was listening to a debate this morning on another radio station about child poverty in British Columbia. And the only argument was that the numbers being used were not correct. And also, a member of the Christie government was saying, well, we're going to open 1,000 more places for childcare, something like that. But then the question is, who's going to pay for it? If people don't have money to pay for it, what's the good of having these vacant spots where you can send your children? And then I was watching on television about education in the United States. Of 36 nations, the U.S. is number 32, which means that they're very bottom in terms of early childhood education. And it was the same way with grade 1, 2, 3, 4, and so on. And here, we're not much better if we are, but instead of fixing the problem, we just say we're not as bad as they are. How bad do you have to get before you got to fix something? When I first came to Canada, hearing about somebody getting shot was almost unheard of. Now it's sort of an everyday occurrence, but we're still saying, but we're not as bad as the Americans. How many you got to kill before you say, hey, we got a problem? And all this stuff with this elder abuse, the rapes, all the rest of the stuff that's going on, we just say we're not as bad as the Americans. We got cops killing people, and yet nobody ever gets charged. So what happened to government? Government was created to stop the excesses of monarchies and also of dictators. But instead of taking care of people, they're taking care of business. I don't have the answers. I often think about them to try to figure out what I would do or what's possible. But I do know it's how we used to deal with things. In oral history, I had oral history, and I've talked to oral historians from other peoples that tell very much the same stories. The story I know goes back 15 cycles. One cycle is about 5,200 years, 5,200 years. So you go back 15 cycles at 78,000 years ago. And it coincides with what Western science has identified as the eruption of a super or giant, whatever you call it, volcano around Indonesia. And in digging down through the ash, which was something like 9 meters deep, they found spear points. And then the question was, how could people have survived that? Well, our history tells how we survived it. And when the people were preparing for it, they were storing food in caves. They learned how to dry food. And so food was being put in caves. And the spiritual leader in Haida, we call it Shaga. Shaga called the people together and warned them, when you begin amassing things, you have to be very careful, because if you're not, the worm could get in your mind and create a need for stuff you don't need. And if that happens, you become skoju. That means you start grabbing and you can't stop. To protect against it, it said you always have to give something back. And that doesn't mean if I take somebody's book, whatever, and I just replace it. What it meant, and still means, is that if we're hungry and we're searching for food, and one of our relatives, animal, bird, fish, plant, presents itself as food, we say, we're giving this one back. You never take that first one. No matter how hungry you are, you always give back that first one. And this ensures that whoever's following after you is going to have something. There'll always be something for them. And then you always stop short in taking however much you're taking. You don't take all you can carry. You just take what you need and maybe a little extra. And that's when we learn to preserve food, drying fish and animals and smoking and this sort of thing. But we didn't decimate whole populations. Now, it said that Indians decimated most of the buffalo with those buffalo jumps. But again, there's no proof that that ever happened, except there's proof that the buffalo jumps did happen, but as far as decimating the herds, that's not true. But anyway, it said that when you start grabbing, you can't stop. You start believing, I can never have too much. And when I first heard the story, one of the stories of the creation, the one about Adam and Eve, and they talk about this serpent, well, instead of saying God cursed women and blame everything on women, what it says is that serpent got into their minds and created a need for something they didn't need. Well, in this case, it was to cover their bodies, clothing, because they were ashamed that their creator would see them naked. Well, it sounds like somebody didn't pay attention when they were warned about giving back. And so, If you keep reading that book, you'll find out how people started grabbing and grabbing and grabbing and killing and doing anything to grab more of something that belonged to somebody else. And that's what all wars are fought over. Somebody wants something somebody else has. And the way my mother characterized it, she said there are people who steal their grandmother's false teeth. Doesn't mean they need them, but they just take them because they can't help it. So when we take a look at our societies, the difference between the indigenous societies from which modern industrialized societies emerged, we all come from that same beginning, that same look at the world. That's not resources, that's my relatives. And we came from the same thing of giving back. But now we look at it differently. We look at the world in terms of relative scarcity. That's what our economics is based on. The more scarce, the higher the price. So somebody will buy the last bluefin tuna. Somebody will buy the last drop of water. Somebody will buy the last whatever. But once something becomes extinct, that means it's gone forever. It can't come back. And so it's sort of like a song that said that Tom Jones was singing about to live for today and love for tomorrow is the wisdom of a fool. Because if you live for today, you're not thinking anything about what else, and you're loving for tomorrow, you don't have anything. So, is our society really built on all these fallacies? At what point do we hit a tipping point? In the 1920s, 1929, in the United States, people were making money that you couldn't believe, but it was called kiting. It was all on paper, all paper transactions, and then all of a sudden somebody dropped something and the whole thing collapsed. Here in Canada, it's referred to as the Dirty 30s. But it was a Great Depression that affected the whole world because people were grabbing and grabbing and grabbing. And that's what's happening here today in Kitsilano. When those two ladies were talking about you could buy a house for $100,000 that you couldn't buy for $1 million here. Well, I lived at a residence. Well, my wife actually moved in here 29 years ago, and I came along 22 years ago. We got evicted for renovations so the rent could be raised $600 a month. No thank you, not another thing. And you figure, in the 29 years, we probably paid somewhere in the neighborhood of about $60,000 over 30 years. So we paid their mortgage, their son's education, but not even thank you, just get out. I want to make more money. So that doesn't tell me much about loyalty. Used to be, if you had a job somewhere, there was a sense of loyalty from both employer and employee. Now that no longer exists. It's all about how can I grab as much as I can. So that's what people are doing. They're grabbing. And why are we fighting bombing other people over in the Middle East? Because it affects our money. Canada's an oil-producing country. So we've got to go over there and shut them down so that we can sell our oil. Whatever. I don't know what the reasoning is involved in. So these are just idle thoughts. These are the thoughts that run through my head. I don't know if any of them are valid. I'm not going to try to prove any of them. But some of this came from something that this friend of mine here, Robin, was in junior high school, and they gave him a Native Land Claims and Native Rights fact sheet. And what years was that, Alan, Robin?
I think it was 93, maybe 94, around that time.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I started reading some of the things that were in there, and it's really quite interesting. Something that's quite different is that it says fast facts. All of North and South America were settled by First Nations people around 20 to 30,000 years ago. And the present authorities tend to say around 10,000 years ago. But things keep messing them up. They find Clovis Man, they find these other things that were 13, 15,000 years ago. Even the underground, underwater remnants of Haida habitation that goes back 13,000 years, something like that, that's underwater. And our history tells what it was like before it was underwater. And I was really quite pleased when I heard they discovered it, because nobody would believe it, you know, when we tell them that history. And then I started reading about this Royal Proclamation of 1763, and it says that's when Native people's occupation of North America began, or of Canada. Actually, what it was is there were two Royal Proclamations, one in 1761 that went from Florida up to approximately Maine, and then was extended on up to Nova Scotia or somewhere up there in 1763. But what it was is that the governors of these colonies, the colonies were just corporations, and the governor was the chief executive officer, the CEO. So this was an economic endeavor. It wasn't a political position. They were making their own agreements with the tribes. And you might have a governor's daughter would marry the son of a chief, or the son would marry the daughter of a chief. And so they made these agreements. And so to put a stop to it, in 1761, a royal proclamation was issued that forbid, upon pain of our royal displeasure, something like that, any crown subject from going west of the headwaters of any river flowing into the Atlantic Ocean. And that was to keep them out of the Ohio Valley. And also it was to stop these CEOs, these governors, from acquiring land. And then it was extended on up to Nova Scotia, and then it says it was the land was reserved to the Indians for that could only be extinguished by the crown. And so the legal effect of that royal proclamation would have been the same if the royal proclamation had reserved all the lands east of the English Channel to the French. You know, it would have no legal effect. So how could the British Crown reserve lands for Indians when it was already theirs? And so the legal authorities say that's when First Nations occupation of the land began in 1763. So anyway, in reading some of these things, it's actually quite accurate what the this fact sheet they gave you. But one of the differences between what happened here and in the States they have reservations. A reservation means that the land is owned by that tribe. They own every bit of it. It's reserved specifically for them. Whereas here in Canada, a reserve is lands reserved for a federal purpose, in which the bands don't own one teaspoon of land. They own nothing. They have certificates of occupation that permits them to occupy. And it's only policy, it's not law. So if they decide to get rid of a reserve, they just say, snap your fingers, it's gone. Toward the end of World War II, the Crown took lands from Indian reserves and set them aside to be given to veterans as land grants. And so when the veterans, you know, return home from the war, they get these land grants, except if you're Native American. And especially if you're a status Indian who came from reserves, because once you joined the British Army, which the Canadian contingent of the British Army, you became enfranchised. Now you're a Crown subject rather than a status Indian, which means that you could no longer go back to your reserve, because now you're enfranchised, you can vote. And also, since you came from reserve, you're not eligible for one of these land grants. So when you start looking at how it's evolved, I'm not going to settle it. I don't have the answers to it. So what I do is I start teaching the cultural values that are inherent in our languages, and that's what this radio program is all about, language to language. It's looking at how we define ourselves, the world around us, and our relationship to it. Because it said that if each people came into being, they were put on a land that looked like them, were given a language that sounded like that land, that describes that land, the relationship between humans and all other beings, their other relatives, and given the ceremonies to maintain the balance. So those are the things that I teach, rather than getting all caught up in political rhetoric of, and it's sort of like when I first went to university in 1959, which is the University of Washington in Seattle, and I took a course on how to take exams. And one of the exams we took consisted of one word, why. And I had just come right from residential school to the University of Washington. And when I first got there, I didn't even really know what a university was, let alone where it was located. But I got there and I found my way there. So I sat and looked around the rest of the class, and everybody was writing furiously, and I hadn't a clue as to what to write. So I just wrote one word, handed my paper in, and left. As it turned out, I had the only correct answer to the question. Why? Because. There is never an answer to the question of why. And so it's just simply because. So I don't try to find definitive answers to anything. Our history describes many, many things, different ways of seeing, different ways of looking at the world. And so I guess we should do a PSA, something right now. And I've moved my chair, it keeps squeaking.
Whoever said money can't buy you friends obviously wasn't a member at CITR. When you become a member, you get the Friends of CITR card with incredible discounts in the Main Street area at
Antisocial Skateboard Shop, Devil May Wear, Lucky's Comics, Neptune Records, RX Comics, Red Cat Records, the Regional Assembly of Text, the Wallflower Modern Diner, and Woo Vintage Clothing.
To find out more, visit us in room 233 of the sub on the UBC campus or go online to citr.ca.
Studying abroad looks great on your resume and opens doors for exciting career paths. Don't miss the Study and Go Abroad Fair on Wednesday, February 25th from 2 p.m. to 6 p.m. at the Vancouver Convention Center East Ballroom. Admission is free. Come early at 1 p.m. to listen to our feature seminar. For more information, check out the website studyandgoabroad.com.
This is your captain speaking. Your next destination is
the sound of compost and recyclables going into the garbage. Garbage that ends up in the landfill creating greenhouse gases. This is the sound of a more sustainable campus. You can make a difference when you sort it out. Learn more at sustain.ubc.ca/sortitout.
How much do you know about bikes? Everything? Perfect. Nothing at all? Even better. At the UBC Bike Kitchen, you can use our space and tools to do your own bike maintenance, get one-on-one instruction on how to fix your bike yourself, or drop your bike off for us to repair. You can also buy a fully refurbished, guaranteed used bicycle, or a variety of new and used parts and accessories. The Bike Kitchen is UBC's non-profit, student-owned, full-service bike shop. We're located in the basement of the Student Union Building. Just look for the stairwell on the north side of the sub across from Gage Towers, or search for the UBC Bike Kitchen on Facebook. Stop by the Bike Kitchen, and then get riding.
Well, we're back here. I think I'll read this short story from Robert Kogo. He's a Haida from Alaska. And it's called Eagle Brings Good Luck. We call Eagle Tsak, but we got that word from the Dene people. After the ice melted and people returning to the north, the bald eagle came with them from the south. And the bald eagle was not out on Haida Gwaii yet. It didn't get there till later. So the word Tsak is a word from their language. And also the word Yacht is from the Dene-speaking people, the Tlingit. Our word in Haida is Huye. But anyway, so Tsak is the eagle and Yacht is raven. The eagle, Tsak, is not as prominent in Haida Haida's mythology as raven, Yacht. This is true because Yacht was most numerous around villages. Eagle, Tsak, was also a late arrival on the scene, came out of the mainland, and on his arrival was given the Haida name Hoot. Hoot actually is the immature one. That's when the feathers are brown and mottled white. But anyway, Eagle was very reserved and kept away from everyday trials of the village, we call it Lana. Also, in the stories of Raven, Raven is a benefactor, crafty, helpful, mischievous, plays perverse jokes to remind us that we're not in control. And he's always hungry, he's always trying to, always up to stealing his food from others. Eagle, on the other hand, was always a hustler and caught his food fresh. It is a belief among the members of the Eagle, we'll say clan, that the Eagle is a benefactor to the group in food. Oh, food and valuables, gidak and good luck. Angung is good luck. In Haida vocabulary, you come across the word hoot, which in the old Haida meant eagle. Tsak was borrowed from Tlingit and is used exclusively by Haidas. Yacht, raven, is also used by Haidas, and that's a Tlingit word. They call it yeet. I'll now tell you a short story about my late uncle Robinson Beatty, whose Haida name was Hutkawas, which means eagle entering water. We were covering the creek flats, Huntai, near North Pass, Yuk-Ik, when we came to some freshwater pools. Near one of the pools sat an eagle preening his feathers with water. Near the eagle lay a fresh salmon, which Eagle had retrieved from the bay. As the salmon was large, Eagle had evidently had a hard time getting it on shore. Eagle was drying out and getting the salt out of its feathers. My uncle, who was of the Eagle clan like myself, immediately rose to the occasion and went into a ritual of good omen. He undressed and entered the pool near the eagle and bathed in this manner. All this time the eagle never moved but watched us intently. My uncle had fulfilled the obligation of satisfying the deity. Good luck would come our way. We took half of the salmon and left the rest for Eagle. When we left, Eagle was still watching us. My uncle thanked Eagle in Haida, Hawak Agi, Dangant Lankilagan. Thank you, our benefactor. To you we give our gratitude, is what he said. After this, we experienced good luck. We got deer, Kaat, ducks ate eat and fish chained to bring home. This could also be a story of moral. If you're of the eagle clan, you see an eagle bathing and preening its feathers in a pool, do not forget to enter the pool. My uncle, Ka, had an eagle tattoo over his back. It was a beautiful design, and work was done by well-paid experts after the work was authorized and revealed during a potlatch with Lal. This is when he acquired the name Eagle Entering the Water, Ertkwas. My father was telling me about this man. All we knew him by was the nickname Crow. His name was Robinson Beatty. And so people had heard the story of Robinson Crusoe. So he was called Crusoe. They couldn't say Crusoe. They called him Crusoe. And later it became shortened to Crow. So when I was growing up, I knew this little old man by the name of Crow. And my father said this man died, that most people weren't aware of that tattoo on his back. So when his body was laid out, they put his face down so people could see this, because this is a person of great substance before he was put on his back. So I never saw the tattoo. I was a little boy when he died, and I don't know where we were at the time, so I didn't get a chance to see that. But this is what I was talking about how we pay attention to the natural world and we treat them as our relatives rather than as resources. Even that salmon chain, there was a ceremony that was done around March, April, possibly April, in which Haidas would gather at a place today is called Cape Lookout. And one of my teachers, uncle, told me that when the people would gather there, there was about 10,000 Haidas would gather on that shore in preparation, and all the men would go out offshore, quite a ways out, 4 or 5 miles out, and some were in a little bit closer, but they would form a line and they would begin trolling for salmon up there. Ta'aun, we call king salmon here in Canada. Ta'aun is called spring salmon. And so as soon as the sun started going up, it doesn't come up in height, it goes up because we're watching it go up rather than looking down at it coming up to us. As the sun was going up, they would put their hooks in the water and they would troll. And they would fish until just before the window to the other side opened. That's when the sun came down. And just as it went below the horizon, the window to the other side would open. And this is when you could send a message to the other side. So they would stop fishing before that time. And they would go ashore and they'd lay out all the fish they'd caught. They'd lay them out with their backs to the north. The north is the place of healing. This Japanese friend of mine used the word blessing. And I asked him, in your language, what does blessing refer to? Oh, he said, that's where you're given a gift of life. It's like everything that you ever need is given to you. The air you breathe, the water you drink, the food you ingest, the comfort, all this stuff is given to you. And I said, you know, in Haida, the color black refers to the comfort of darkness, which is the same thing. It's a place of healing where you return to the womb, where everything is given to you. So the north is this place of healing, this place of comfort and safety. So that's why the back of the salmon was faced toward the north. And the people would sing for them. And just as the sun is going down, that's when the fish were cut, the heads were taken off, the fins, the tails, and they had huge pits dug. And they'd been heating rocks all day. And these red-hot rocks were put in the bottom of this pit and lined the bottom of it. And these pits were maybe 6 to 10 feet across. And then they would put down a layer of leaves. Usually it was when the skunk cabbage was first coming up. They'd lay out those leaves and then layer fish and layer leaves, layer fish, and there were poles put down in there like fence posts. And then when it was done, they would cover the whole thing with sand. And then they would pull this post out, and so now there's a hole all the way down to the red hot rocks, and they'd pour seawater in there, and this would generate steam. Then they'd put that plug back in and pull the next one. And so this is what they do. They pour enough water down there to make steam. And this cooking process would go on for most of the night until Shanglanai. When the daylight arrives, you're watching for it. You don't see it coming until it's actually there. This is when the light sweeps away the dark. And so at Shanglanai, then the sand, everything was removed, the fish were removed, and everyone ate. And when everybody finished eating, then all the heads, the tails, the fins, and the bones were carried gently to the water's edge. And these things were placed in the water, and it was like a prayer for more to come. And so this is a message to the salmon that we honor our relationship. I'm so thankful I can't even say the words. So then the spirit of these salmon would go back out to sea, and they would tell their relatives that these humans are very good to us. So go see them. So this was done. And then once that was done, then fishing could go on for the rest of the year. So this is how people would honor these things. And even like with the deer, to honor that deer, when the deer presented itself and you caught it, you accepted the gift, you drank a little bit of the blood to take the spirit of that thing. So anyway, these are just some short things. And so growing up, I used to hear these things. I'm not really that old, you know, I'm just barely in my 70s, so I really think of myself as quite young, because in 1944, when my grandfather took me, it was right after my third birthday, to meet these old men. Some of them were over 100 years old then, so they had been born in 1840, some of them before 1840. And so I had that opportunity to be around these old people as I was growing up. A person would go home. We didn't talk about them dying. They go home. They return home. And then another one would be selected. You know, they would select people at birth, and that would become part of this group. So my last teacher died in 1997 at the age of 97. He was born in 1900. So I had that opportunity to learn these things about the way the world looked before contact with the Western European worldviews. So anyway, I'll be passing it whatever I can on about that. And so thank you for listening, and enjoy family day to day, because that's what the world is all about, families. And those of you First Nations people, if you can speak your language, eat all your food, dance your dances, sing your songs, if you walk away from your family, you destroy your culture.
A large man wearing green pants grabbed a woman by the hair and slammed her face into the glass window of a fire extinguisher case. He pulled her head back and hit her again, continuing to do so until the glass broke. The woman sustained deep cuts all over her face and eventually became unresponsive. The man then released his grip and she fell to the floor. This is a scene from an Emmy Award-winning cartoon. If we want violence against women to stop, shouldn't we stop treating it like a joke? Join the conversation at #NotOkay.
It's not just rich people that own the media.
But by leaving out the most important things you need to know, they can elevate awareness to a new all-time low.
I own my media.
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 The Media Co-op is a grassroots national news network that's owned by its members.
But if it's just left out, can you say the paper lied? A lot of things that happened didn't happen after all. If there's
no one in the forest who will put it in the news. I guess the tree didn't fall.
Join us today at mediacoop.ca/join.
I'm joining today. You should too.
I'm Marie Bernard, host of Synchronicity, talk radio for your mind, body, and soul. Join me Mondays at noon as we explore the universal energy that connects us all. Let's discuss our journey of self-discovery, joy, presence, and living with authenticity. We can create positive change in the world, and it starts within each one of us. Synchronicity, talk radio for your mind, body, and soul. Mondays at noon on CITR 101.9 FM, Vancouver.
Hello, welcome to Synchronicity Talk Radio for your mind, body, and soul. I'm your host, Marie Bernard. This is CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver, or you might be listening online at cosmicdimensions.com, empowerradio.com, or on the Co-Creator Network, or you could be listening on CITR.ca. Today, happy Family Day if you're in British Columbia, Canada. It's a holiday here today. And we are going to be talking about living a wholehearted life. Today, we're speaking with Susan Reeve. She has 40 years of experience as a self-esteem expert, master coach, corporate consultant, interfaith minister, and award-winning author. And yet the title that best captures her wholehearted life is Godmother. As a teen, she wrote in her journal, "What would the world be like if everyone loved themselves?" This question informs her commitment to partner with clients and guide them in deepening and expanding their capacity to experience vibrant self-esteem and success in all arenas of their lives. She has been a delegate to the UN Commission on the Status of Women and an adjunct associate professor of management at New York University, focusing on leadership and interpersonal and group dynamics. And she is a member of the New Thought Center of Eastern Long Island and is one of the ministers offering the Sunday service message. So you can find her at susanreeve.com, and it's S-U-S-Y-N, Susan with a Y, Reeve.com. And the book we're discussing is her latest book, The Wholehearted Life, Big Changes and Greater Happiness, Week by Week. Welcome to the show, Susan.
It's so great to be here with you today, Marie.
Thank you so much. And you are stuck in your house in a snowstorm. So how are you living most wholeheartedly when things are totally out of your control right now?
I am feeling really cozy, happy to be inside, and glad that this is something that I had to look forward to today.
Yay! And the Skype seems to be working out too, so that's good. I'm happy.
Yes, I still can't get out of my driveway right now. So it's really a day to appreciate that I'm able to stay in the house. I have a computer here that works, and all is well.
Good. Wonderful. Well, let's get talking about your book. So this is a week by week. I guess the idea is to start in January, but since everyone's kind of, I imagine a lot of people are kind of giving up on their New Year's resolutions, so this is a good time to remind people of keeping themselves happy and healthy.
Yeah, this is a book. It's a book that you can do over the course of a year if you are disciplined to focus on a particular chapter week by week. I think it's a really great book to do with a friend or a small group and support one another through that process of going through. I'll just give you some of the chapter titles: breathe, have a new thought, smile, smell the flowers, eat dessert first, write your obituary, be the world's greatest lover. So there are a variety of different areas of focus that ultimately have us be aligned in body, mind, and spirit.
Beautiful. Well, I like the chapter. Well, I mean, there's 52 things to go through. And so you have a little bit to do each day too, right?
Yeah, each chapter has an inspiring quote, has an essay about the concept that the chapter focuses on. Some chapters have personal stories or teaching stories that have influenced me throughout the years, and then 7 days of exercise.